Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker is European author Dubravka Ogrešić. Moderating tonight's discussion is Igor Lukas, Boston University Professor of International Relations and History. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director Vivian Schmidt.
Welcome to Europe in Sepia, a reading and conversation with European author Dubravka Ogrešić. So over the past three decades, Dubravka Ogrešić has established herself as one of Europe's most distinctive novelists and essayists. From her early postmodernist excursions to her elegiac reckonings in fiction and the essay with the disintegration of her Yugoslav homeland and the fall of the Berlin Wall, through to her more recent writings on popular and literary culture, Ogrešić's work is marked by a rare combination of irony, polemic, and compassion. Following degrees in comparative and Russian literature, Ogrešić worked for many years at the University of Zagreb's Institute for Theory of Literature, successfully pursuing parallel careers as both a writer and as a scholar. In 1991, when war broke out in the former Yugoslavia, Ogrešić took a firm anti-war stance, critically dissecting retrograde Croatian and Serbian nationalism, the stupidity and criminality of war, and as a result became a target for nationalist journalists, politicians, and fellow writers in the process. Subjected to prolonged public ostracism and persistent media harassment, she left Croatia in 1993. In a voluntary exile that has in time become emigration, her books have been translated into over 20 languages. She has taught at a number of American and European universities, Harvard, UCLA, and the Free University of Berlin among them. She is the winner of several major literary prizes. Her recent work, Karaoke Culture, in 2011, was awarded the Jean Améry Essay Prize, and she was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. Her most recent writings appear in Salmagundi, The Baffler, these are the USA, Gazeta Wyborcza, Poland, and other prominent international periodicals. She lives in Amsterdam. Moderating tonight's event is Igor Lukas, Professor of International Relations and History here at Boston University and Honorary Consul General of the Czech Republic in Boston. Without further ado.
Good evening. It's a wonderful opportunity for me to say a few words about our distinguished guest. Someone told me once that the Greeks were able to invent what we think of as Western philosophy because they considered themselves as neither masters of the universe nor as irrelevant specks of dust. Instead, they assumed the position of observers. And I believe that something similar could be said about our guest tonight, Dubravka Ogrešić. She is, as I understand her, an observer. She comes to America, where she comments on Susan Sontag. She puts Lenin and Attorney General Ashcroft shoulder to shoulder in one sentence. She notes the freedom of the vagina monologues and the persecution of smokers. She does the same thing in the Netherlands, where she notes that her students, but this scene has now become famous, support themselves by assembling items for an S&M shop that supplies a sex club at The Hague. It so happens that the sex club is called the Ministry of Pain, which happens to be the title of Dubrovka's 2005 book, The Ministry of Pain. Although, of course, others, the more conventionally inclined, they would associate The Hague with international courts, such as the one dealing with crimes committed in the 1990s in the Balkans. One could argue, of course, justly, that that observing America is a well-established industry, well-established tradition, certainly from the days of de Tocqueville. And I'm sure the same applies to noticing the irony behind the Ministry of Pain coexisting at The Hague in the vicinity with all the international criminal courts. Dubravka deserves to be admired as an observer because she does much more than absorb the strange world around us. She courageously remains an observer rather than a participant, an unreflexing participant, even in her native Croatia. Unlike many policymakers in the West and in the United States, Kohl, Genscher in Germany come to mind, Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, President Clinton, Ambassador Holbrooke, they all sought to explain the Yugoslav wars as a simple contest between the good and the evil, wherein you had the evil Mr. Milosevic in one corner, painted as a communist or crypto-communist evil person, and the others were well-meaning Democrats. And as I understand it, Ugrasic was certainly willing to be scathing about Milosevic, but she could be equally scathing about Franjo Tudjman, the Croat president who tried to rehabilitate the wartime Croat state, the NDH, as a historical and moral antecedent for the new Croatia that he proposed to build on the ruins of the imploded Yugoslav state. Dubravka flatly refused the offer to join in this immoral enterprise, and this is why she was, as we heard from Vivian, driven out of the country as a subversive traitor, and curiously also the label was applied of a witch. Her books, essays, thoughtful interviews are a mixture of fiction, satire, and some autobiography, and always biting and scrupulously truthful commentary on the world we live in. Under all circumstances, she's a true Aristotelian zoon politikon, and even if politics is mostly distasteful, she follows it and understands it better than many professionals. But her real passion, I believe, is for the arts. Her writing is based on a very broad intellectual repertoire, inimitable, I think, in this country, where in addition to the Westerners, she includes Gogol and Tolstoy. And as we have already discussed, she includes such intellectual gems as Bohumil Hrabal's Too Loud a Solitude, or indeed Karel Čapek's completely forgotten fairy tales, including The Postman's Tale, which is just wonderful. Wherever she goes, Dubravka is introduced as a Croat writer, and this is true everywhere except in Croatia, where no one knows what label to put on her. I see in this a testament to her authenticity. Dubravka Ugrešić.
Thank you very much, and thank you, all of you, for coming. It is nice to be in Boston again. Europe in sepia. Of late, I've caught myself turning the faces and spaces of Central Europe into photographs. An automatic click on an internal camera, and I'm done. A second later, an iPhoto program whirs inside me. Import, effects, sepia, done. It's as if the surrounding reality is a screen stuck to my hand, an invisible remote with three options: past, present, future. But only one of them works, past, sepia. Maybe a recent sleepless night in Bratislava triggered the reflex. The hotel room had an unusual dummy window facing not outwards to the exterior, but inwards to the interior, to the reception. I kept the window closed and curtains drawn, both of which appeared to increase the density of the claustrophobia in the air. Having flagged efforts to try and fall asleep, it was probably around 2 in the morning when I opened the new edition of The Economist and stared long at the map of Europe divided into 3 color zones. An alarming red color marked countries in recession, yellow, the countries somehow muddling through, and green, the absence of recession. Slovakia, Estonia, and Slovenia were alone in the green zone. The next day, news reports announced that Slovenia had just slipped into yellow. In the hope it might send me to sleep, I gave a tourist brochure I'd picked up at the reception a browse. On a map of Slovakia, a settlement bearing my name northwest of Bratislava caught my eye. Rather than surprise or delight, "Look, the little spot and I have the same name." In a flash of recognition, I was overcome by the fact that ours was a kinship based on inconsequence and insignificance. Ah, that Slavic linguistic sisterhood, Dub, Dubrava, all those forests and woods, leaves and oaks, hills and valleys, water and wetlands. In Slovak, all so painfully similar to my native tongue. My eye glides solemnly over the Slovak places, names, as if searching for lines. There's Slovenski grob, and look, Horvatski grob, grob, gerb, brijeg, grb, berlok, graba. Grave, crest, hill, then dike. Shouldn't Zagreb actually be Zagrob? A burial place, not merely a settlement next to the humdrum hill or common dike. The borders of the brochure team with advertisements, roast duck, goulash, gingerbread hearts, girls in national dress wearing flower wreaths in their hair, and then there are the bold harbingers of the new time, Thai massage, sushi bar. I wondered about my sullenness and what lay at its root. It's entirely possible that, as a child, I had been warned not according to Greenwich, but rather to a socialist clock, one always rushing on ahead into the brighter future, towards progress. A tomorrow envisaged as a majestic fireworks display of thousands shapes and colors. Maybe my child's imagination, tattooed with the heroism of a little dog named Laika and the promise of an impending trip to the moon, permanently adrenalized the horizons of my expectations. Or did technological innovations pervert my horizons, and now, appetite unchecked, I expect the surrounding reality to behave like a 3D film, more impressive than its actual self. isn't my sullenness the recognition that I'd set off for a place I'd categorically never set foot before, and lo and behold, arrived home? Maybe I carry a Central European blueprint with my everywhere, with me everywhere, and on entering the Central European zone, I compare my internal sketch with the situation on the ground, my copy with the hues of my surroundings, utterly incapable of finding pleasure in the beauty of small differences. Doesn't my soundness lie in the uncanny confrontation with my own position on the map? I mean, we all scratch where itch is most. Didn't I, preparing for the trip, toddle through the internet and the history of Slovak literature and catch myself reading with a distinct lack of enthusiasm the exact same way I would read the history of Croatian literature, and that consequently, among the forlorn names of Slovak writers, I can easily imagine my own. Wasn't a sleepless night in a Bratislava hotel room with a dummy window facing not the exterior, but the interior, simply a painful confrontation with my own insignificance? If that's how it was, what the hell is with my colonial arrogance, this eruption of an almost actionable political incorrectness, my arbitrary establishing coordinates of significance and insignificance? Why do crappy pictures of plates of goulash induce nausea and not a good cheer? I'm no vegetarian. I have no call for sullenness. Slovakia is not my country. I'm here for the first time and as a guest. The hotel room with the dummy window isn't my apartment. My hosts are exceptionally gracious. Goulash is a tasty dish. Bratislava, a city on Danube, and the Danube, Dunav, Duna, Dunaj, Donau, Danube, Tuna, Dunarea, a river with its source in the Black Forest and its mouth at the Black Sea. Spanning the Danube and leading into Bratislava is what used to be known as the Bridge of Slovak National Uprising, a communist architectural hangover resembling a giant two-legged robot, its head shaped like a Pyrex dish in which a rotating restaurant sat atop. Roast duck on his plate and his head in the clouds, a communist Slovak might well have felt he held the whole world in the palm of his hand. For a time, towers with rotating restaurants were communist architectural chic. In the restaurant atop the TV tower on Berlin Alexanderplatz, the waitresses dress in retro-style GDR uniforms, giving their all to be as slow as they were in good old times. Maniacal communism had maniacal architectural pretensions. Many still hold the Stalinist Seven Sisters of Moscow for architectural farce, though the skyscrapers were built on American models and differ little from those of New York. Today, the bridge in Bratislava is simply called the New Bridge. Once ambitiously announcing a modern future, the bridge drops you down into the sleepy heart of the old town, and affectingly Lilliputan statue of Maria Theresa on horseback greeting the visitor. Like a toy stolen from a kindergarten, Maria Theresa sits opaquely in the November fog. With the faded yellow and greens of its facades, Bratislava seems half deserted and unusually quiet, the fog like a silencer. From this side of the Danube, the bridge appears in the same fog as a grandiose futuristic promise. We, 10 intellectuals, are in town to talk of the escalation of the euro crisis, of fear and uncertainty, the fragile fabric of contemporary social and state structures, and of the humiliating absence of future projects and projections. The majority of us are writers on demand. We play amateur sermonizers. The professionals, those who really know their stuff, are in the negligible minority. Cultural managers, small-time NGO bosses, editors of obscure magazines, university lecturers, students and volunteers, everyone is here. My tribe. Summoned, we gather, give each other a passing sniff, wag our tails, bark a little, and then we withdraw until the next time. EU pennies tinkle down the invisible pipes of Brussels, gratefully collected by the hands of those who call us to assembly. Crisis. Crisis, crisis, the word buzzes among the old theater walls like a pesky fly. We talk, our words visibly frayed, banging into each other like heads against a wall. The air is stifling, there's a yawn in the audience, a lack of oxygen. The theater became cramped. Central, Eastern, Southeastern Europe, it's a landscape I know like the back of my hand. They were different in the time of communism. Only the iconography was the same. Now, it's as if the fall of communism has felt the difference. I know how people here breathe, the way they hide themselves, playing dead, like a fox in a fable, peasant cunning. They lower their gaze in conversation with outsiders. Practiced in the art of restrained movement, answering every question with I don't know. That I don't know, always accompanied by a wistful smile. They swallow the dumpling of betrayal on a daily basis, fret about making ends meet, walking on tiptoes to prevent a breach, as if expecting the dam to burst and the envisaged flood to sweep away all in its path. They don't try planting flowers. Gardening is a belief in the future, and they have no future. Peasants' fatalism and moronic sayings are what remain to them. We have always got by. We've always, and we always will somehow. They huddle together, withdraw into their own shells, shrinking to their true dinky stature, only to then peddle this dinkiness as their chief virtue. They're hawkers of cheap souvenirs, angel figurines everywhere, the Slovaks stealing them from the Poles, the Czechs from the Slovaks. Croats sell gingerbread hearts and little bags of lavender. Few display any imagination. Imagination doesn't sell. They want UNESCO to protect their non-material resources. The Croats have already hawked off Kulen and Sopernik. Yes, they live off souvenirs, like European Indians in a European reservation. Honey cookies, gingerbread, bit of folklore, embroidery and lacework. Olive oil from hand-picked olives, traditional local recipes. At the markets of neighboring Vienna, these Indians, Serbs, Gypsies, Macedonians, sell fake Roman coins and fibulas. Their squaws, women with bleached hair and faces roasted like Chinese smoked duck, sunbeds are still in fashion, are rag pickers, traders in original fakes, clothing, caps, and scarves. Everyone sells his or her bric-a-brac. Yes, the future is definitely elsewhere. In the time of communism, watches sped ahead. Now they go backwards. To bridge the time difference, today parents herd their kids towards Singapore, Australia, Hong Kong, and Asia. No, not to Western Europe. That's all over. Sure, after the fall of the wall, everyone perked up a bit, breathed a sigh of relief, made themselves comfy in their new statelets. But you have to pay to play. So some stole, others slaughtered, and the others just enjoyed a little bum rushing. In time, their heels cooled, and they bowed their heads as if occupied by an invisible force. Now here they are, back where they always were. And what do you want? Says my interlocutor, a Croat. Everyone has always walked all over us, and yes, we bowed our heads, shut our mouths, and divided into tribes. We Slavs are a sad people. We never had, and nor will we ever have, a Joyce or a Beckett. Do you know why? Because Vladimir and Estragon, that's us. We've been waiting around for centuries for someone to come, to fall from the sky. Waiting's all we have ever done. We are artists when it comes to waiting. Maybe that's why, unlike others, we have never conquered or subjugated anyone. They've conquered us. Our rebellion is small beer. All we do is get drunk, smash our heads against the wall, and maybe slit our veins with broken glass from the floor. What did we inherit from the ancient Slavs? The art of breathing underwater. Breathing through a reed, an authentic Slavic innovation. We have never been ambitious. Vienna, you say? We don't care about Vienna, and neither do Slovaks. Bratislava wants to be Linz, Zagreb to be Graz or Trieste. That's the reach of our ambition. Yes, we are endangered, like Indians. Hence our efforts to protect what remains. Language, a little mythology, a few of ancient handcrafts, handicrafts. Our differences are small, beer too. Some of us pray to God of rain, others to the God of sun. Some do their Ganga, others blow their penny whistles. We regularly summon our ghosts, excavating our ancestors' bones. We count for nothing. We don't produce anything, nor do we have the money to buy anything. We are neither producers nor consumers. No one needs us, not even our own kids. A racing pulse, tachycardia, fatigue, nausea, anxiety, crisis. The rules of etiquette didn't prevent me fleeing Bratislava before time was called. Once home, in Croatia, in Zagreb, no, in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, I quickly forgot my 2-day Slovak episode. I deleted everything. Only one picture managed to sneak into my internal album. The tiny sculpture of Maria Theresa on horseback, twinkling opaquely in the November fog, sepia. Brought on by a fresh incident here at home, a new anxiety attack soon runs me down. Hert Wilders Party, the PVV, or Partei für die Freiheit, launches a website cordially inviting Dutch citizens to have their say on burning questions. Do you have problems with recent arrivals from Central Europe or Eastern Europe? Have you lost your job because of a Pole, Bulgarian, Romanian, or some other East European? The website is visited by tens of thousands of people giving vent to their resentment at the legal presence of Central, East, and Southern European immigrants. Poles, especially the Poles, because it's the Poles who are taking their jobs. Poles steal, get drunk, they're loud and liable to criminal behavior. Poles are human trash. There's no reason for alarm. I'm not a Pole. For now, I still pass as a Croat with a Dutch passport. The ex-Yugoslav and Bulgarian in me, I'll easily hush up. I'll freeze like a fox in a fable until this storm too passes. I diligently pay my taxes to this water-soaked country. The dump doesn't bother me. We Slavs are used to forests and trees, leaves and oaks, water and wetlands. My mems are active. They remember the old Slavic art of breathing underwater. Maybe my anxiety attack is just a storm in a teacup. It seems that way, for now, until some new storm rolls in. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Nothing depresses me so much as optimists. And your wonderful dose of darkness makes me just ecstatic. I find it perfectly realistic. Thank you so much for this wonderful essay. And now may I invite questions from the audience, please? Yes, please.
I'm just curious, actually, about the reaction to your work from young people from the region, like maybe in their 20s or 30s. I'm just curious about sort of their reaction to your work.
They adore me. You know, recently, editor, main editor of a big publishing house in Germany, it is called Hanser Verlag, and his name is Michael Kruger. So he gave an interview after being in publishing industry and writer himself too for some 40 years. So, and he said, unfortunately, I realize after those 40 years devoted to books and writing and reading, that majority of readers like just bad books.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much for reading your essay. I have two related questions. One is about translation, and if you would share with us whether you did the translation or someone else did the translation. But the related question is, how do you imagine your audience? Clearly, you talk about a very small community here, but my sense is that that you have a broader sense of your audience, and I just wondered, as you write, how you think about audience.
You know what? Unfortunately, I don't imagine the audience. If I would imagine my audience, if I would clearly know for whom I'm writing, I would be probably much richer than I am. So let's say that I do really write for this imagined ideal reader or listener, and my writing is that constant sort of, you know, dialogue with that invisible ideal reader or listener. So, oh yes, I do. I wouldn't survive without my translators, because my position is pretty, I would say, unpopular and pretty rare too. I mean, not many writers. I mean, usually, first of all, I left Croatia. I still write in Croatian. Croatian is a small language. There are not many translators from Croatian. One of them, Ellen Elias Bursac, who translated my books, is sitting here. But those people are really rare. And then also, I moved to Netherlands. I moved when I was too old for exile, I mean, for complexity of that position, and too old to switch in a different language, especially writing language. So that position is tough by itself, and that's why unless devoted few people, translators, I wouldn't manage. It's a basically invalid position, you know. And people, writers, either they stay in their countries, you know, and write for their local audiences, and if country is big, as America is big, then you are okay. But if a country is so small, then that you are not, you have to wait to be translated. And especially if you are in this out-of-nation zone, because neither Dutch take me as their writer, neither Croats take me as their writer anymore, or they do, but I'm in a special corner as a problem or whatever.
I was just wondering, who are some literary writers that you find yourself in mental conversation with in recent times?
You know, there is There is a fantastic feeling, you know, of sort of blessed envy. And this is literary envy. And that envy helped Nabokov to write a wonderful book about Gogol. So a master wrote masterly about writer he envied honestly on his craft. And whenever I read Bohumil Hrabal, whom we mentioned, I feel this blessed envy. And I'm totally aware that I would never be able to write so divinely as Bohumil Hrabal wrote. Or let's say, whenever I read Isaac Babel, who is my favorite writer, I'm always impressed how anybody can write the whole world in just 5 pages. So these are the writers, or some special books, which I really, really admire. And I think that this is also, apart from translators, which keeps me go on and alive, where I see that writing has some sense if you have such a fantastic examples. They're sort of light in the darkness. I mean, in this sort of light in this global market, book market.
Sorry, thank you so much. I have one question, because since your position, like, you know, as a as a member of the intelligentsia, as an author who, like, you who's traveled a lot and have experienced a lot in Europe, my question is, like, just recently, what is your take on how people feel, how people think about the future of the EU, and also one thing I've heard more and more people talking about, a threat to democracy. Do you think in the debate and discussion, is there any kind of threat of radicalism, or any kind of threat to democracy in Europe?
I think that people are simply cautious, and people are silent, you know. People are silent because they don't... they're cautious because they don't know how to position themselves, you know. So you have rarely articulated and honest approach to that problem. So why? For instance, it depends, of course, of a context. But if you have anti-EU tendencies, let's say in Croatia, bearers of those anti-EU tendencies are local nationalists and fascists, you know. So they are sort of deleting or sort of stopping any productive, let's say, criticism against the concept of EU. Because I don't want to be together with those guys, okay? So it is very difficult. That's why it is very difficult for people to sort of loudly and honestly position themselves, because it is very easily, you know, to label people, because we don't have patience for complexity of situations. So you have right and you have late, right and left, and you have those nationalists and you have those pro-European forces, and that's it. So let us make things sort of easier. But that does not solve the problem, you know, because there are questions who should be put to the whole concept, and all those concepts like democracy, like state, like this and that, they are worn out, really. They are like moth-eaten flags. And because sort of systems, big systems, compromise themselves, you know, and there is no projection or anything like on the horizon, like a third system, people are simply insecure, cautious, they go with the stream, and they're afraid to go against. But Europe itself is a problematic place, with really many problems.
Hi, I'm Magdalena. You've been rightly called that you're an observer. What is it about human nature that interests you, fascinates you, or puzzles you the most? Is it social behavior, psychology, interaction, or there are deep secrets, or anything that really fascinates you about people?
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm observer, you know. I would say something else, because, first of all, I write fiction, novels, short stories, and I write essays. And essay is a form which is dear to me. And I realized that I started to write essay, and I found that form suits me, that it is extremely comfortable, and that it is mine, you know. And it was complete sort of freedom in that form. That's how I felt. And then I found wonderful. I don't know exactly what he said, so I can't really quote it. But there is a wonderful Theodor Adorno's essay on essays. And as much as I remember correctly, he said something that very heart of the essay, what it keeps it alive, why that form is so important, it's that it is heresis is a heart of essay. And heresis is not just observation, and that's why I'm not observer, I would say. So, and that's why I like essay, because within every little paragraph or within in the very heart lies heresies. That is what makes me and writing essays, what makes it so exciting for me. And I think it's the right form for me, that questioning, you know, questioning of anything. It could be banal, trivial thing of why do we drink those little infantile bottles of water and so on and so forth.
Thank you for your reading. I would like to say that I find that there's so much hope in your work, in the beauty of your sentences. And I'd like to ask you a question about your writing. Your sentences are so ambitious and far-reaching and heartbreaking and funny and so smart and sharp. And I'd like to know that if your sentences in translated form, which is how I've always read them, how they compare to your sentences in their original version, and also how involved you are in that process of finding them in their translated form.
One can't be always lucky, you know, with the translators. And sometimes, I mean, very often you don't know your translators at all. But what concerns English language, and especially because I can check, I've been lucky because I mean, my translator is my friend, and for instance, and the other translator is also a friend. So we can, and the translator who died, his name was Michael Henry Heim, he translated two of my books. And he was also a friend, so that we could discuss things freely and passionately too, you know, and quarrel and exchange. I even didn't know that it was so passionate. But there is tomorrow there will be panel discussion in his honor, and before that I checked. I found correspondence which I saved. Mail correspondence, and there I found out how passionate our exchange of thoughts was about certain sentences and words, and so that's the beauty, I think, because I like to collab. I like to, you know, to do that somehow together, as much as translators want me. I'm ready to collaborate.
All right. Well, then, thank you so much for this presentation. Thank you for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with European author Dubravka Ogrešić. Tonight's event was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal AGNI. Our moderator was Igor Lukas, Boston University Professor of International Relations and History. We began with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director Vivian Schmidt. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Michael Garth and James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.